right? So how can we take even this standardized curriculum that you have to do and figure out ways to turn up the liberatory elements of it, to bring in student identity, to bring in place, right? To bring in democratization where the students are having voice and choice. So you're still meeting the requirements of this district and what you have to do, but being able to do it in a way that is like spirit filling and like nurturing to young people and what they want to learn.
Welcome to Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I'm your host and chief goddess of the PASS Foundation, Annalise Corbin. We know the current model for education is obsolete. It was designed to create fleets of assembly line workers, not the thinkers and problem solvers needed today. We've seen the innovations that are possible within education, and it's our goal to leave the box behind and reimagine what education can look like in your own backyard. Welcome to today's episode of Learning Unboxed. As always, I'm excited to talk with another great innovator in the transformative education space. And joining us today is Dr. Michelle Pledger, founder of Living for Liberation and director of Liberation at the High Tech High Graduate School of Education. So Michelle, welcome to Learning Unboxed.
Hi, Annalise. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited for our conversation today.
I'm thrilled to have this conversation. I've been wanting to have this conversation ever since we met last summer. And so I'm super excited to sort of dig into some of your work. Let's set some context for our listeners as we get started. They come to us from all over the world. So Living for Liberation designs immersive learning experiences and curates content to help people liberate self, systems, and society. They provide professional development as well as print and digital resources to support educators, nonprofit leaders, companies, and community organizers cultivate liberatory ways of knowing, being, and doing. That's a lot. And that's a heavy lift.
It is a lot. And I love every bit of it. So if you think about our lives, we are constantly faced with some form of oppression, right? Whether it's internalized oppression, interpersonal oppression, ideological oppression, institutional oppression. And so how great would it be if we could free ourselves from all of that? And so I love working with educators, women, just humans, anybody breathing who is trying to get free from something. And so when I think about liberation in terms of self, the things we're getting liberated from are like imposter syndrome, self-doubt, overthinking, fear, internalized oppression. When I think about systems, a lot of times it's supremacy culture tenets, entrenched policies and processes, right? Institutionalized oppression. And then when I think about society, it's that interpersonal oppression, microaggressions, comparison, scarcity, fear of other people, fear of open conflict that we're working through. And then the through line through all three of those forms. Ideological oppression runs through all three of those, self, systems, and society. But yeah, I just love it. I think it's because, well, I know it's because I spent so much of my life feeling oppressed and fearful and not free, right? And so now, and it's still aspirational, right? Like we're always every day trying to be more and more free. I heard Lama Murad Owen say that everyone's free. They just don't know it yet. You know, like we're all free, but we don't know it yet because we've been socialized or in these institutions and we have ways of being that are super oppressive, but living free is so much more enjoyable. Than
absolutely. Than I hear free. That. Yes, absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit, Michelle. I'm curious. Your background is fascinating as it relates to the way you have over many years now, really intersected and have meaningful impact in the practices within the K-12 education space. So if you don't mind, just high level, share just a little bit about the why Michelle in K-12.
Yeah, that's a great question. Because growing up, I didn't know that I was going to be a teacher. Right. I had different aspirations. I knew that I wanted to, like, at one point I said, I want to just jet set and do lunches. And I didn't really know what I was going to be jet setting.
And can doing we all lunches. Jet set and do lunches?
Right? And so it wasn't until actually grad school when I was getting my master's that I realized that anytime I had an opportunity to work in the summer or on the side, I was always choosing something that had to do with teaching, right? Whether it was teaching dance, teaching young people. And it dawned on me after my first year of graduate school for something totally different. I was in a program for master's in Pacific International Affairs with a regional specialization in Latin America and a career concentration in international development and nonprofit management. It had nothing to do with education. And after that first year of grad school, when I realized, oh, shoot, I think I actually want to be a teacher. What do I do with this? Right. And thankfully, I had someone in my program told me about a school called High Tech High International. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, this is awesome. Like, I'll use this degree in international affairs. I will go to this school. I will tell them they need to have an international studies course and that they should hire me to teach it. So I did that. They didn't create a course for me, sadly. But the interview went really well and my teaching demo went really well. And they were like, hey, we're not going to create a course for you there, but you could teach either US history and American literature, or you could teach Spanish. And so I chose US history and American literature. And I didn't have degrees in any of these things. But the great thing about High Tech High at that time is like you could earn your credential while you were teaching. So I studied for all the CSETs and passed the CSETs, got in the credential program and just started teaching. And it was very much fail your way to success. Mm-hmm. I would say my first project was a hot mess of just final products. Like the kids didn't know where it was going because I didn't know where the project was going. So it wasn't their fault at all. But I got better. And I taught in the High Tech High space for 12 years in K-12, 2 years at High Tech High International and 10 years at High Tech High North County before I moved over to the graduate school, which is where I've been at for several years.
Wow. So that's quite the journey. And I would argue that, you know, all that graduate work is absolutely relevant to teaching. So I don't think that that mattered quite so much. And I am a huge fan of all things High Tech High. Always have been. I can't tell you over the years how many groups of educators I've taken there. We've toured, we've talked about it. I'm like, this is the mothership, right? What's happening here is one of those baseline fundamental and foundational sort of things. And that's where we got our idea of the meta titles from, right? Was actually from our colleagues at High Tech High. So
I did not know that. That's awesome.
Absolutely. Yes. Over the years. But with that in mind, I want to dig in just a little bit to the idea of living for liberation and the way that you've then taken that organization and the approach of that organization and why it's so important and have been able to incorporate it into the High Tech High graduate school. And I'm curious about the intersections. So the teaching that you do now, right, in terms of the educator prep space, how do you feel like that you effectively roll these two roles together, right? Mm. And the knowledge base that comes from the pieces of work.
Yeah. Oh, this is a juicy question. Well, and my work with High Tech High precedes my work with my company. Mm-hmm. So I'll start there. So thankfully, because I'm director of liberation, which again, aspirational title, we're all trying to get.
We love those, right? I mean, the reality of it is though, that you're bringing that with you. It's our cultural baggage that shows up with us everywhere we go.
Right. And people always compliment the title. They think it's like an amazing title. Mm-hmm. But there, what I get to do is I support our DEI and liberation capacity building for our internal faculty and staff. And so that consists of monthly PDs, that consists of some coaching, things like that. But I also work across several project teams and I get to use that expertise in those teams as well. And I'll just share a couple of them with you and you can decide which rabbit hole you want to go down. But when I'm working with the Center for Love and Justice, we work with teachers and students at school sites who are shifting from traditional curriculum to liberatory project-based learning. So this means young people are experiencing a learning environment that is culturally responsive and centered in knowing and improving the world around them. And we do this using equity stances, identity, belonging, place, dialogue, democratization, all in service of liberation. So I love working on that team because that's the team where I get to work with teachers and students still. So that feels really good. Another team I work on is Improvement for Equity by Design. Now, we support network leaders who are using improvement science, or some people call it continuous improvement. There's a huge debate about that. But they use that to achieve equitable processes and outcomes for young people, right? So that's higher level And also I love working on that team. Mm-hmm. And I get to use a lot of my equity and liberation work there. And then our deeper learning conferences that, you know, I've probably maybe attended. Yep. We have them in San Diego every year. We have one upcoming in March, but we've actually expanded those conferences because we didn't want it to limit to only people who could come to San Diego once a year. Like, how do we know deeper learning is happening everywhere? And how do we bring people together in different regional spaces? And so we have Deeper Learning Global. So this year mm-hmm. we had Deeper Learning China in December. In June, we're going to have Deeper Learning LATAM, which is going to be in Medellin, Colombia. Mm-hmm. We've got Deeper Learning New York in July. But it's just been awesome to just see it have its own flair in these different spaces because it looks different in every country, right? In every city. And then, of course, I teach courses in the graduate school yeah. around culturally responsive teaching. And mm-hmm. then I teach in the EDL program. So there's just a lot. And so all of the work that I get to do there that's aligned with DEI work or liberation work mm-hmm. It's connected to what I get to do for Living for Liberation. I would say the difference other than Living for Liberation being my own company is I really get to hone in on self work. And different workshops and keynotes and my podcasts and my book, just like really get to be mm-hmm. in my passion when it comes to Living for Liberation, but they're very connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's dig in on that just a little bit then, since that is your passion and we love that so much. So when you think about two things, I guess, so, and I'll ask them both and you can tackle this however makes the most sense for you. So when you think about the educators that you encounter who are seeking to bring your work and the bigger, broader implications of the work that you're doing, it's critically important. It's going to change kids' lives for all the positive reasons, ways, you know, and long-term outcomes. So when you start working with folks that are interested in changing their own environment, their ecosystem, their practice, and their interactions through this work, how do you help them? Well, I guess, but let me back up. What's the point of readiness, right? Because, you know, oftentimes folks will hear a thing and they're like, hey, I want to do that. But you and I both know you're not ready to do that thing sometimes, right? And so there's a process that folks have to be worked through let's start with that. How do you determine when there's truly readiness to go down this road? Because I assume, and if I'm wrong, please let me know, that you're talking about a journey.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think the benefit, particularly when it comes to Living for Liberation, is that folks who are reaching out to me, let's say mm-hmm. for a Freedom Dreaming workshop or a Living for Liberation series, in a space where they're hungry for that work. I'm not in the mm-hmm. business of convincing people that they need to care about equity right. and liberation. That's like somebody else's, that's not my ministry. That's somebody else's work to do. So people who are usually coming to me, they're already pretty willing and ready. Mm-hmm. And so, but maybe don't have the tools and support. And even in the first chapter of Liberate, I wrote a book called Liberate: Pocket-Sized Paradigms for Liberatory Learning. But the first chapter that talks about liberating your consciousness, it really makes it clear, actually before that, in the introduction, if you haven't done your self work mm-hmm. around and understanding how your background impacts your beliefs and your beliefs impact your biases that impact your behaviors in the classroom and how you show up for students, right? That inner work is really important and we need to do that first. And I have workshops that help people mm-hmm. go through that. But even in the book, it's like, I don't want you trying out these practices if you haven't done right. that inner work first, right? To your point, not everybody's ready for mm-hmm. it. So, and then in my series, like especially the Living for Liberation series, we're doing a lot of that self-work first, right? Where people are actually unpacking those background beliefs, biases, and behavior mm-hmm. and starting to have some revelations. They're getting an opportunity to practice having conversations about race, conversations about other identity markers that maybe they haven't had yet because of out of fear, right? A fear mm-hmm. of saying the wrong mm-hmm. thing. So it's you work through that in a really safe and protected space. And I don't mean safe in that there aren't brave things happening and you're not pushed out of your comfort zone, but we create a container where we might mess up together, but we're going to like lean on each other, love each other enough to hold each other accountable for doing better, right? And mm-hmm. also in that particular series, we look at processes and policies in our workplace that are leading to oppressive ways of being and ways of doing things? And how do we disrupt those?
Okay, so one of the things that we've been talking about is the idea of the journey and how folks can sometimes get in their own way as it relates to being ready to do the incredible work that you do through Living for Liberation. So I guess the essence of my question is, we often don't know what we don't know, and life is in fact filled with these sort of pieces and parts. But when we don't know where we truly are, it can hamper our ability to connect with our kids in our classroom or to be truly a meaningful facilitator of open and compassionate learning. So how do you help folks work through that piece of the understanding to know they've got work themselves to do?
Yeah, that's great, because self-awareness is key, right? Because if we're not practicing that self-awareness, then we're making assumptions about how kids feel about us, how we feel about a situation. And that's why when you look at the book Liberate, it goes in sections, and it starts with liberating our consciousness, right? And there's like a key piece in there, like, as teachers, we must acknowledge that our intersectional identities and our background experiences shape the way we view and interact in the world, and also the way we interact in a classroom. Therefore, it's really impossible for us to enter any space as neutral. And the fun thing about identity is that we have so many identity markers. So we have background experiences in all of these identity markers. And someone can feel really culturally proficient when it comes to race, for example. Like, I love talking about race. I could talk about it all day, every day. Then they may feel like less culturally proficient when it comes to talking about LGBTQ plus, right? Or socioeconomic status. So the beauty is we're all in different places, right? So we can be further along in the path here, but really stuck and like in need a lot of room for growth in other areas. So none of us have it all figured out. There's not a single human being who you look at every single identity marker and they're like, you know what, I'm culturally proficient in all of these. I can speak to these. I'm self-aware. I interact excellently in all these areas. It's just not true. A couple years ago, I realized that there was some internalized misogyny that was still like in me. I was at a conference and saw these women. I had this thought. And anyway, the thought was very remnant of like, whoa, I was like, whoa, where did that come from? Because I don't believe this thought that I had about women. I don't know if you want me to go into the
concrete
specifics.
Please do. No. Okay. I think it gives it context. You just go there.
Okay. I was at a conference for financial literacy, and the conference was geared toward Black people and developing their financial literacy. And I happened to be in line for something, and I saw these Black women, and they were dressed a certain way that was different than how I was dressed. And my first thought was, oh, they're here to try to meet a man who's like on the come up, like who's learning from these. And as soon as I had it, I was like, Michelle, like, what the freak? Where did that come from? Because I'm a woman and I'm at this conference, and I'm not at this conference because I'm trying to meet a man who's on his financial literacy come up journey, right? And so I had to like, where did, you know, and that I was socialized to have these beliefs that, hey, if a woman dresses like this, looks like that, has this type of makeup, then it means they're X. When no, those women were very well there just like I was. And so of course you go through your shame spiral of like, oh my gosh, how did I have that belief about my own gender and all those things? But what's most important is like, what do you do after, right? Once you like notice the inequity that you have in your own mind and thought processes, like, okay, I can discern like, where did that come from? How do I want to make sure that doesn't happen in the future, that I'm not making assumptions like that in the future? How do I want to interrupt that? And like, one of the frameworks that's free on my website is called Notice, Name, Navigate. And it's all about that, right? Like, because we're never going to get it right all the time. But how can we notice something, name it for what it is, right? I've noticed what that feeling and my thought pattern, named it for the internalized misogyny that it was. And then how do you navigate that? All right. I'm going to figure out how to like not make that same mistake in the future, or how to make sure I'm having like affirming and asset-based thoughts about the people around me. So it's elements like that of just that consciousness, that level of awareness. And then the book takes us through, well, how do we liberate our classroom structures so that they're more conducive to culturally and linguistically diverse students? How do we liberate our curriculum, right? Our communication, like there's so many different things we have to think of as educators, as you're in the space as well. And so there's so many opportunities for us to harm young people, sadly. And even for like liberating your communication, I always say there's a human being on the other side of my words all the time, whether it's young people or adults, there's a human being on the other side of those words. So what I'm saying and how I'm communicating matters. So how am I communicating in ways that feel inclusive, loving, supportive, right? So yeah, it's just a short how-to guide. And it has resources, recommended resources for people to do deeper learning. But the reason why I wanted this pocket-sized book is because oftentimes, educators, I know when I was a classroom teacher, I did not have time to read like long books of theory and like, and there's great stuff in there. I'm not knocking those books. I've read them after I left the K-12 classroom. I had some time to read, but like, what would it look like to have like for educators who are already there, they already know that they want to be doing better by young people. They just need a little bit of help in terms of how to, some concrete examples of try this, right? Mm-hmm, adapt this mm-hmm. way. And it's pocket size. It literally fits in their pocket and they yep. can take it around. I've had a teacher who she showed me a picture of her. She used her so much, the pages fell out, mm-hmm, right? Because mm-hmm. she just kept referring to it. So I actually sent her a free copy of another one. Like, girl, you need another book.
You need a new book.
Yeah, it's something that people can just go back to again and again.
Yeah. And as I recall, you had the book last summer at the conference there, or there were copies of it there. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Because
I sold out there too, yeah, which was great.
I remember seeing people, right? They had them, right? Yeah, absolutely. So I'm super curious. Can we dig in just maybe to one example of how this actually works in the classroom? I just want to give folks a taste of some of the ways that through this work and through that book and the resources that you have on your website, or if they come and get the privilege of being able to do a workshop with you and learn from you, what are some of those like key strategies that can actually help that educator then facilitate the same behaviors or that we're looking to self for, to adjust, to grow, to learn from with their students in the classroom?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually today was teaching some of our educators or pre-service teachers who are earning their teaching credential in our San Diego Teacher Residency Program. And they're in a course called Introduction to Culturally Responsive Sustaining Pedagogy. And one of the concrete things we're working on specifically is around how to integrate cultural competence, critical consciousness, and cognitive capacity development into the teaching and learning, right? And so with those teachers, and we're not trying to do everything all at once, especially because they're pre-service teachers. But for example, when we're looking at the cultural competence element and thinking about how are we integrating students' identity into the designs of our lesson, into our teaching and learning, then after we have that module and they're learning about what it means to elevate cultural competence and they're learning about different identity markers, then we're actually drafting lesson plans, or we call it put it to practice. Like, okay, so this week you're going to try to design a lesson or an experience that integrates cultural competence in some way, shape, form, or fashion. And we're going to reflect on that the following week. Like, how did it go? Are we going to adapt, or abandon what you tried? Like, what are you noticing? And so that's just for cultural competence. And we do the same thing for critical consciousness, how to surface, challenge, and change societal inequities. How do we make young people not only aware, right? And we know Paulo Freire, he talks about these steps, right? There's critical analysis, right? There's sense of agency, and then there's critical action. So how are we helping young people analyze the world around? They're living in it just like we are, right? So it's not like us not bringing it up doesn't mean it's not happening for them. So how do we support them in making meaning of the world around them, realizing that they have a sense of agency or some way that they can impact it, right? Whether that's through awareness or contribution or what have you. And then that last piece, that critical action, something that used to really frustrate me and what I really appreciate about project-based learning is that teachers might have a social justice project where they just surface like all the horrible crap that's happening in the world. And then kids just get to sit with that. There's nothing they feel like they can do about it, which what I appreciate about project-based learning is that I always had the opportunity, like if we're going to elevate some social justice issues or get into critical consciousness and students are learning about injustices in the world, that's not enough. Like, how do you give avenues for authentic action, right? And so how do we create that sense of agency? Actually, yeah, we're talking about this issue, but you know what? There's something that we can do about it as a ninth grade class or an 11th grade class or what have you. And then the space for actual critical action. Let's do something.
Let's do a
and
thing.
Students, yeah. And students like feel like, okay, this learning is relevant. It's rigorous, but it also has value and meaning. I see the purpose, right? And that really, it influences engagement, but it also influences achievement because like when you got to have engagement before you can get to the learning anyway, right? But the key thing when we're on the critical consciousness element, we talk about enjoy before injustice, right? We talk about people's counter narratives, or I call them like more accurate narratives of a particular group of people before we go into the like oppressed segments of that so that young people understand, right, that people aren't all one thing, right? There's this right. multiplicity of the human experience. And then that third element, cognitive capacity development, that's when we're supporting young people to navigate like productive struggle or that's what Zaretta Hammond calls it, productive struggle. James Nottingham calls it cognitive conflict. But anyway, how do you support young people to move through those learning pits? So those are the concrete things my pre-service teachers are working on and reporting back on. And they come back with stories of like, I tried this. What do you do? And that's what the beauty of it is we're exploring all of that in community. So they're leaning on the other educators in the cohort to respond to some of those grapples that they're having, as well as myself.
One of the things I really, really appreciate about this piece of the conversation we just had is that one of the elements in my mind, anyway, that we're talking about is giving kids the space to connect with and feel their own, not just their power and their agency, because they're going to get that, absolutely, but you're also allowing them to see themselves in the thing that you're actually talking about doing, right? Because in that project or problem-based environment, however it's being approached, the reality is as those kids then take on whatever those elements are, that service, that thing that we can actually do to solve this problem or to be part of this bigger, broader solution set, it's not going to look the same for the child here and then the child over here, right? Because they are two different humans. And what I love about what you're talking about is providing the grace and the space, if you will, for them to figure out how that's going to be meaningful to them.
Yes, because they're the experts of their, a lot of people ask like, well, I don't know everything about this culture or this student or all these things. And it's like, you don't need to know everything. They know about themselves, right? So you're creating space and opportunity for them. Goldie Muhammad always talks about this question of how are students learning more about themselves and how are students learning more about others, right? So it's really about like that giving space, like you said, creating that container for their input, their interest. And it's not in a tokenized way. Like, and there are some teachers who are really excellent at co-design. I remember a teacher named Kaylee Frederick at one of the high-tech high schools. Her and her teaching partner, they would not plan the year at all until they met their students. So I'm too intimately acquainted with my control issues, so I wasn't that free yet. But they would wait, they would meet their students, and then they would co-design the entire year with their young people. Every project came from the students. Every unit came from the students. And that, not every school site and teacher has that autonomy. I understand that. But in that space, it was phenomenal. I was blown away every year. There was a lot of voice and choice in my class, but I'm a planner, so I needed to have something.
Now that is really impressive and brave, right? Because like you said, very few of us, right, can do that, I think, right? It would just be really scary, and that's okay too. So I love that.
Yeah.
I always like to make sure that as I'm thinking about wrapping the conversations, recognizing that as we move forward, there are many ways to apply the work that you're doing through Living for Liberation or even through your work through the High Tech High Graduate School. But I'm really curious, Michelle, as you think about the things that get you super excited around what's going on in the world of education, because post-pandemic, as a collective set of educators or facilitators of learning, there's still a lot of struggle that's going on. The world is struggling in many ways. We're feeling it deeply in lots of different ways. But what's out there that gets you really excited about education?
Oh, there's so many things that excite me about education. I think what I'm really, this week anyway, you could ask me this question next week and it might be different, but this week, there's a group of educators that we work with, Center for Love and Justice, and in different contexts, and they have different constraints, right? Because they're like, I work with a crew in Hawaii, some people in Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York. So they have different demographics, all the things. But I'm just really impressed and just really inspired by the ways that teachers who are about this liberatory project-based learning life, regardless of the constraints that are happening in their space, trying to figure out how to make it work and do what's best for young people. And one of the schools that we work in, they have a curriculum that they have to use that curriculum. It's been assigned. There's people who check up on them to make sure they're using it. But they understand the value of liberatory project-based learning. And so we've been working with them on a process that my colleague Tina Schuster came up with called like turning up the gain or turning up the dial on liberatory, right? So how can we take even this standardized curriculum that you have to do and figure out ways to turn up the liberatory elements of it, to bring in student identity, to bring in place, right? To bring in democratization where the students are having voice and choice. So you're still meeting the requirements of this district and what you have to do, but being able to do it in a way that is like spirit filling and like nurturing to young people and what they want to learn. And so just, I'm impressed by, regardless of what's happening, teachers' ability to like persevere and keep their eye on the prize of like, what is best for the young people in front of me? And how can I like go around over underneath these other constraints that are oftentimes just like political and just like have nothing to do with education to get what students need? So that really fires me up.
Yeah, I get that because that's phenomenal, right? And like you said, been in this workspace and seeing the power of doing that very thing, right? Recognizing, hey, I have to do this thing, but we can still make it better, make it more meaningful. We have the control and the power over how it's all going to be transmitted, if you will, and how our students are going to engage with it. Exactly. And even for ourselves. So I really love that. So that's awesome. Michelle, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to have this conversation with us here on Learning Unboxed. I really appreciate it. And I cannot wait for you to get back into my neck of the woods. And so I'm hoping that we can get together in real time and continue the conversation, because honestly, I could have this conversation with you for hours on end. So I appreciate your work so much.
Thank you, Annalise. I love to talk. So you better be careful what you wish for. But seriously, I really do appreciate this opportunity to just share time and space with you and share a little bit about my work. And I'm looking forward to seeing you this summer in Ohio.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I want to thank my guests and encourage you all to be part of the conversation. Meet me on social media at Annalise Corbin and join me next time as we stand up, step back, and lean in to reimagine education.